We are a politics podcast, and our theory of being a politics podcast is that all this stuff is the basis of the way that we express ourselves politically. Mm-hmm. Do you feel good enough in your relationships? Do you have enough relationships? How lonely are you?
Oh, God, that is so fascinating. That is very, very perceptive.
This is Sarah Stewart Holland.
And this is Beth Silvers.
Thank you for joining us for Pantsuit Politics. Welcome to another episode of Pantsuit Politics. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, we are going to start by discussing the truly wonderful news that the team of bipartisan senators have reached a deal on gun safety legislation. Then our main segment, we'll share our conversation with writer and new Pulitzer Prize winner, Jennifer Senior. And then, of course, we'll wrap up by tackling what's on our minds outside politics.
We have been watching the January 6th committee hearings. We watched the first primetime hearing on Hot Mic, as we mentioned last week. We watched Monday's hearing together. Sarah was on Instagram Live. I was on Twitter. We think it is really important to watch these hearings in their entireties. And so we're doing our best to create easy and supportive environments for you to do the same. So we hope that when you're able to join us live, you'll do that. And we hope that what we've created will facilitate your understanding if you aren't able to watch live. And we really do encourage you to find the full hearing when you have a chance to sit down and watch it and pay attention, because it continues to be extremely significant, as we'll discuss more in just a moment.
Have you ever experienced a dry, itchy scalp or ever wondered why your color isn't lasting as long as your hairdresser promised? Well, unfiltered, mineral-filled water could be the reason why. Did you know hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin? And that about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered showerhead comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered showerhead. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered showerhead is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze. We put it in, it took like 30 seconds, guys. And its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people, and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert, and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit. Episode that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June Mani system at home, because we can all get a good looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon grade tools that are so easily explained, so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. the Olive & June Manny System is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Manny System.
So we are recording on Monday and have just finished watching the second public hearing from the House Select Committee on the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. And today's hearing really laid out the case that former President Donald Trump told the whole entire world that if he lost the election, there was fraud before, way before the election. I was struck at one point where they put up footage of him talking in April of 2020, saying, if I lost, it's because they stole the election in April. They also lay out in a lot of detail that he ignored every bit of advice and evidence from his advisors and lawyers, Ivanka, Bill Barr. I think the Bill Barr testimony continues to be incredibly impactful. But all kinds of professionals from the DOJ and his own attorneys and his campaign manager, who was supposed to testify live, but his wife went into labor, and they pivoted with that sort of last-minute change very well, I thought. And then lastly, that he used the big lie to not only subvert the election, but to raise fraudulent funds from his supporters. They show how they sent all these emails up into the moment he was at the Ellipse giving his speech at the rally, and that they raised millions and millions of dollars, none of which that went into the fund they claimed it was going to go into in all these emails, but rather was like passed out to like Mark Meadows Charitable Fund and Event Strategies, which actually helped plan the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th. So a lot of like follow the money towards the end of the hearing and continuing to build the case that Donald Trump is at the center of all of this.
Yeah, Representative Cheney put it that this was part one of the 7-part plan, and that we're just going to continue to walk down that path to understand all 7 parts using, again, that kind of patchwork of live testimony, recorded testimony from witnesses. I thought one of the best moments in this hearing was a scrolling list of comments mm-hmm. from judges who have commented on and considered Trump's election fraud claims.
Over 60 of them.
Just showing over and over again that this was not credible. That was the message today. Everybody knew that this was not credible. And yet Trump continued to fundraise from it and continued to do, you know, as Attorney General Barr said, a real disservice to the American public by causing people to lose faith in our elections.
Mm. So the next hearing is on Wednesday the 15th. Again, we will be watching. Beth will be on Twitter. I'll be on Instagram. We love to watch with you guys because the chat is supportive and helpful. People ask questions. People ask each other's questions. People sometimes answer my question when I couldn't remember Brad Parscale's name today. It's very helpful. So if you're looking for an environment where you can sort of watch along with other people, we got you covered. Over the weekend, thousands and thousands of Americans marched across the country for the March for Our Lives, demanding legislation to address the gun crisis in our country. And it looks like we might actually get it. The team of 20 senators, both Democrats and Republicans, that have been working dedicatedly to break this logjam that has existed for a generation when it comes to legislation addressing guns in the United States seems to have reached a deal. I was thrilled when I saw the news, Beth.
I cannot say enough good things about Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
who has been advocating on this issue since Sandy Hook, who accepts the reality of the United States Senate is willing to work within it, who has said, I will work with anyone on any mm-hmm. scrap of anything that might prevent anyone else from dying this way. Mm-hmm. And I think it is his tenacity and his communication and his humility that is bringing us to this place where we are going to, some lives will be saved from this legislation. Is it everything everyone has ever wanted? No, but it is good. This is good, solid work that has a realistic opportunity to pass, and I'm thrilled.
They have not officially written it up into legislation, but here's the framework that they're proposing that they've gotten support for from 10 Republican senators, support from Nancy Pelosi, and support from President Biden. The first major change is a more thorough review process for people between the ages of 18 and 21 who go to buy a gun, a high-capacity weapon like the AR-15. So under a background check review, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System would have to also contact state and local law enforcement. They would check for any disqualifying mental health or juvenile records. It could take up to 10 days for someone that age to clear this process and get a high-capacity weapon. So that's obviously an acknowledgement, particularly the last two terrible shootings perpetuated by 18-year-olds in Uvalde and Buffalo.
And if you look at school shootings in general, these are typically done by young people. And so anything that we can do to make it harder for young people to get this kind of deadly power, I think is important.
Next up, they have put together a formulation for grants for states to put in place these red flag laws so that if a person has been flagged as concerned from their family members or from law enforcement, then they can have their weapons seized. And I thought what was really interesting about this is it's not just states that are creating these laws, but even states that have these in place already can receive funds and resources. I mean, this is a motivation situation. This is, we need the states to pass these laws. Let's motivate them to do that. But I think these red flag laws are something that a lot of people can come together and agree on. We don't want people in delicate mental health situations, and everybody knows it, to be able to get weapons or keep the weapons they already have.
This money is important because a criticism of red flag laws in terms of their effectiveness is how disparately they are enforced across the country. And that's going to happen because they involve discretion, and discretion is needed in these situations. But it's also true that red flag laws place one more job in front of the court system. And in many states, the state court system is overtaxed and underfunded. You know, that there are long dockets, judges are handling too big of caseloads, they don't have enough staff to do everything that they need to do. So getting more money to actually enforce these laws, even in states that already have them on the books, I think is a really significant step.
The next thing, and you can tell some of these parts of the framework are sort of a nod to more conservative concerns or more conservative calls for change. There is funding for school security. There's a major investment to increase access to mental health and suicide prevention programs. And listen, you know, even if they're sort of on the conservative lifts, they're not bad ideas. I'm not opposed to them. I'm not opposed to more funding for schools to increase their security. What I'm opposed to is that is the only solution to this problem. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with putting funding like this in place and increasing resources. I mean, I was reading the other day, the suicide prevention hotline is really having trouble with like funding and staffing. So if some of that money can go ease the burden there, I think that's great.
There's also a closure of a loophole around intimate partner violence that has existed for too long. The fact that we still call it the boyfriend loophole tells you how long people have been working on this issue. No one would call it that today, but it's been around for a while. We have mechanisms to deal with guns where there's been domestic violence among spouses, but not where people are unmarried. And so this legislation would close that loophole.
And that just got removed from the Violence Against Women reauthorization like a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. So I think that, I mean, there have been a couple senators that have been working on this and working on this. And I'm thrilled to see this on the list. They're also working on going after straw purchasers and people who help other people illegally purchase weapons. They're clarifying the definition of a federally licensed firearm dealer. And it would require more firearm sellers who are proven to be engaged in the business of selling firearms, quote unquote, to be put on a notice that they need to register to become federally licensed firearm dealers. So none of these sort of like gray area deals that are going down.
There are also school security resources. So we know that Republicans in particular like to talk about hardening schools. The press release around this proposal says that legislation will provide money to help institute safety measures in and around primary and secondary schools, while also supporting school violence prevention efforts and training for school employees and students. And I think that bullet point demonstrates how significant the details will be as this legislation is actually crafted, that the negotiation will be ongoing. It is tough to make new laws, That's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately as it relates to the assassination attempt on Justice Kavanaugh. We've gotten some messages from people saying, why aren't you talking more about this? Why isn't the House passing something to protect Supreme Court justices? And I would just say it's tough to make new laws, and it takes some time and some thought to decide what's appropriate here. And I think figuring out what the school security portion of this means will be critical. But I'm like you, Sarah. I'm open to all ideas that help us make progress here and that keep anybody a little bit more safe.
And what I just wanted was movement.
Mm-hmm.
It has felt like for decades that we were stuck, that we had decided we could not legislate anything around guns. And so to see this list, to see that a group of senators have come together and said, no, there are things we can agree on when it comes to gun legislation, it feels momentous. It feels miraculous to me. And so if you called your senator, if you went by their office, if you marched, take this moment. Take this moment and think, it works. It works. When we demand change, when the voices get loud enough, even the most contentious, controversial, seemingly intractable issues in American politics can move. Good work, everybody. You know, this is not the end. We have not solved it. We have not fixed it, but it is a start. Next up, we're going to share our conversation with Jennifer Senior, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing, and she is here at Pansy Politics to talk to us about two of her pieces, but specifically her viral piece, It's Your Friends Who Will Break Your Heart.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reads. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love. Chance encounters, a slow burn, friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance through high quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting. I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for this sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit. First of all, huge congratulations are in order. You were awarded the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing for What Bobby McIlvaine Left Behind, which was the most beautiful reflection of a family's loss in the 20 years since 9/11. So congratulations.
Thank you, ma'am. The ideal time to learn that you've won a Pulitzer is not while you are in the midst of finishing and then editing and then closing a piece about Steve Bannon.
I was going to ask what your next piece is.
I was like on the home stretch of that. The cognitive dissonance, like, you know, the kind of elation I felt was so utterly canceled out by the material that I was working on and like the stress of having to close it on time. We had this group Zoom and my editor, you know, all these like shiny, happy, you know, faces. I have the nicest colleagues ever. And my editor-in-chief closed it by saying, "Jen, go back to work and finish your story, and everyone else go and celebrate on Jen's behalf."
Oh, no.
I know. I was like, what is wrong with this picture? Oh, my God. I mean, and if it had been, it could have been about like the copper mines of Nevada. It could have been anything, but it was about Steve Bannon. I mean,
Steve Bannon, of all things,
you know.
Yeah, I have to ask, what compelled you to write about Steve Bannon? How did you make that choice?
Well, I mean, I've always had like politics in my portfolio, and the 2022 elections are coming up, right? So there was only so long I could go without, I couldn't really get away with not writing about politics. At some point, I was going to have to capitulate and just do it. And my editor basically said, you got to choose somebody, anybody, one of the figures, you know, who's out there. And I knew Steve Bannon would say yes, you know, because he's a media guy. And I knew that his podcast played some role in, I thought anyway, in helping to organize some of the energy behind the fury on January 6th. You know, I mean, he's got this very activist listenership, and he's kind of like a preacher or a televangelist, really, would be a better way of describing when he's. So, I mean, you know, and he was game because he's always game. And I think he's like Trump. He pines for mainstream coverage. In hindsight, it was a horrendously bad idea. But, it, you know, of all the figures, I mean, he wanted me to go for somebody, you know, who was Trumpist and part of the conversation. And I knew that he would endure. He wouldn't get knocked out in the middle of a primary, you know, right, by the time it pubbed. I mean, you know, there were all sorts of considerations.
This piece is different. Piece you won the Pulitzer from.
I have
to tell you, you know, in our book, Now What, we talk about staying present with loved ones, even as they engage with a reality you might not completely understand. And I really can't think of a more clear and beautiful example of that than Helen and Bob and the way you write about them in the piece. I really cannot.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate that. And I'm very glad that that came through. And I'll tell you, if I hadn't been able to get the diary, that is what the whole story would have been about. It would have been about their marriage, right? Because, you know, here is a man who descended into 9/11 conspiracies and trutherism as a way to cope with losing his son, just waking up every morning and it's September 12th and there's a murder to be solved, you know, who actually truly was behind September 11th and who killed his kid. And there's a wife who had absolutely no interest at all in going down these rabbit holes and thinking about this, and just had a very different way of coping with their grief. And that was going to be the story if I didn't get the diary, you know. And then it had this then suddenly when it did, it had many, many, many parts. But thank you. Thank you for saying
but
that.
But I think that theme is still even with the diary, like how people deal with it and how to stay present or sometimes not staying present with someone through that sort of grief process. I just, it really, well-deserved. It's an incredible piece.
Thank you. Thanks.
You have another incredible piece that we've not been able to stop thinking about since it published, and that is, it's Your Friends Who Break Your Heart. And you wrote about the great pandemic friendship reckoning in your own life and how in middle age we're past the collection phase with friends and should be enjoying hard-won friendships. And it just doesn't turn out that way for many of us. And I have to tell you, every couple of weeks, I solicit questions from our audience. Just what do you want to hear us talking about? And every time I get a question that sounds like, how do I find friends in this stage of my life? So I would love to hear about what made you decide to do this piece. And now having some distance from it, what parts of it are you still thinking about?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm going to answer the second question first. Like, what am I thinking about now? I am thinking about one of my smartest friend's critiques of the piece. Or not a critique, it was something that he thought was missing, that he would have loved to have read 1,500 or 2,000 words about. He said, in addition to envy, he said, you know what you don't talk about in that piece is anger. Like that, with many friends, not with all of them, but with many friends, there are these large stores of anger that you sit on, and it goes unprocessed, or it doesn't get processed healthily. With a spouse or with children or with family members, there's a better developed vocabulary for discussing anger. And with friends, there often isn't. And it can really corrode, right? And he said, I really wished you'd discussed that. And God, have I been thinking about that ever since? Because he's totally right. And I think, to be honest, I was too afraid of even going there in my head. Like, I could go to envy because I'm lucky enough to have like only very badly envied like, you know, a couple of times in the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, I mean, and I talked about it, you know, it was in the context of Bob, you know, going on Oprah and how great, you know, how gracious and funny he was about it and real he was. But anger is different. And I, you know what, honestly, I have more of that. And I think I just couldn't I couldn't cope with it. So that's like a coda that someone and you guys could talk about, and you could get somebody else to talk about who actually has access to it, because my mind wanders into blank space. I get so freaked out even thinking about it.
Well, I think it's just about what you talk about in the piece, which is to me, envy, anger, all of it is this undercurrent of conflict, and we do not have language, experiences, like guidance, wisdom, writing. We just don't have a lot about how to deal with conflict inside friendship. I'll never forget, I had a really bad falling out with who I'm still friends with, but we had to go through sort of this period. And she said, well, I don't fight with my friends. And then I said, well, how are you even friends? How are you friends if you never have a conflict or a fight? But I just don't think we have language or, like I said, any sort of cultural wisdom about how to deal with any sort of conflict in a friendship. And I think we tell ourselves these lies. We write about this in our book, like, you know, in college, you're sort of in the same grade, you're the same age, and there's this sameness. But even at that period of life, when it's easy to make friends and you're sort of falling into lockstep, you're not the same. And there's still conflict, and there's still anger, and there's still envy, even in those time periods where friendship feels easier. And so if we don't have any language during those easier times to deal with anger or envy and any sort of conflict, well, dang, what are we going to do later in life?
Well, yeah, like 30 years into a friendship, what are you going to do? And I think your response was really a good one, which is, how do you have friends if you don't ever walk through conflict? But of course, there are people who believe, look, friends are there. They're supposed to be the frictionless part of my life, which is a misunderstanding, I think. I can't imagine all friendships being frictionless. The ones that are frictionless are, well, first of all, they're the rarest of elements on the periodic table. You really luck out when that happens. And sometimes it's because, like, I can think, my friend Sarah, there's no friction with her. But why is there no friction with her? Because she doesn't have friction with anybody. Mm. Sarah is born, you know, just with this like extremely even-keeled temperament. Nothing ever phases her. There isn't a particle of anger in her. You know,
this is a hypothetical. It does not describe me. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, right. It doesn't describe anybody I know except my friend Sarah Murray, who is just always like that. And okay, so there's Sarah, and then there's everyone else in my life, you know, and so, and I think that if we want our friendships to be serious and we want them to deepen and we want them to kind of rival the deepest of relationships we have, I think they're going to have to, you're going to have to work through that shit, but it's hard. It's really hard.
My husband and I saw an early screening of Top Gun last night, and I told him I felt like the summary of it is that by middle age, everything is at least 33% heartbreaking.
That's so, oh and my God.
It was like kind of beautiful to just have a movie like Top Gun say that out loud, because I can't imagine frictionless friendships at this stage of my life. We're all just made of too much.
Right. Mm-hmm. We are made of too much. That's beautiful. And 33% heartbreaking. God, it's that Maggie Smith poem that I have to find, you know, all the things she can't tell her daughter, because really life is just so hard. You know, yes. It just is hard. But yes, I think that is true. We are made of too much at this point. And it's beautiful as long as your friends can put up with it. Hey, you want to hear a cool story about what came out of that piece?
Absolutely.
One of the people who I wrote about, I talked about how like I had a falling out with a male friend.
Yes, that became apparent.
Yes, that guy. Yeah. He figured out it was him. He's Steve Metcalf. He's like one of the three guys on Slate Gabfest, on the Culture Gabfest. And he said on the air, I think this is me. And either I'm like really narcissistic, and in which case I'm about to have egg on my face, or it was me and I have egg on my face. Because I think I said something like that to Jen. And I was just young and overwhelmed and a dad. And I was a friend. That's a quote. Like, he got both of them in there. Really impressive. And he said, you know, and I totally loved her. And I'm just really sorry. Mm. And then he reached out to me. I mean, it was just like, he said on the air, like many years later, what he and I could not like kind of work through, you know, and I couldn't do it either. I couldn't say, God, that really hurt my feelings. You have no idea how much that hurt my feelings. So maybe being older also just like helps you, you know, you've been married maybe, and you know, you've had enough fights and learned what works and what doesn't and what you shouldn't say. And, or maybe you're still sucky at fighting, you know, but I mean, it's possible that you have a better sense of how to navigate some of that. Can I go to your first question, which was like, how do you find new friends? I've spoken to ladies who are older and in retirement, or their kids are fully launched, and they say you revisit everybody who you sort of didn't have time for, that they do kind of resurface, they're back, and that you can deepen those friendships again. You'll be surprised at the number of friends who will re-enter your life and you can deepen things with. But in terms of making new friends, if you're in a brand new place, it is a bear. I mean, do you get a dog? You know, you've got something to talk about. It's very, you know, all the cliches. Oh, you know, you find hobby. You know, you can go to bars and restaurants alone. But I mean, but it's hard. I don't have great answers for all of that. I mean, and I'm very afraid of the narrowing, the funnel that comes when you move or when people start to get sick. I mean, it becomes really difficult.
Well, I think some of that hardness is found in something you name in the piece that I want to scratch out a little bit with, which is sort of the embrace of individuality in modern life, right? That we have this sense of like, we're all completely unique individuals, and we all have these completely unique identities and completely unique needs. And if you don't embrace a single part of that, then we're done. I love this line. You say, one could argue that modern life conspires against friendships, even as it requires the bonds of friendships all the more. Like, I think that there's this tension between individuality and sort of the collective that bubbles up in modern friendships. And I think you definitely see that in when you're looking to make new friends in a space, right? One, because we don't have a lot of the civic institutions that fostered that said, like, well, we share this thing. We share this membership. We share. I mean, when I moved back to my hometown, even though it was my hometown and I had friends here, I joined basically like our version of Junior League, which is still very popular here where I live in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And it was, I had like the full experience of friendship, lots of conflict, full on betrayal inside that organization, and also made some of my like strongest friends. But I don't think that sense of like, we have to join in something together that doesn't honor every single piece of our individuality, but will give us some things to share and maybe build friendships off. I think that those things have weakened. And I think that tension we always feel between being our unique selves, being like honored for our individualities, but also finding a place of belonging is really hard right now.
It's really hard. And, you know, not everywhere has junior leagues. You know, you can join a church and just look, you know, but church attendance, all these things are in decline. You know, you can join it and join a synagogue. These attendances are in decline. Robert Putnam wrote about this at length in 2000 in Bowling Alone and has done work on it since. Lots of people have, you know, you can join, you know, a book group. Is your book club going to be there for you if you lose your spouse in the way that your church would have been in the days of old? Probably not, you know, or the Rotary Club or the Elks or all these things that have fallen. It's harder. It's harder. You know, this age of radical individualism has come at a very steep price. I'm back in touch with an old friend. We were friends in college, friends in our 20s. We had kids and sort of that was like a 10 or 12 years where we kind of lost track of each other, right? And we just started hanging out again. And he said, you know, and his father died this year. There's a big memorial coming up for him. And he said, you know, you are welcome to attend. Because I knew his dad, right? You know people's dads when you're in college. And you know them in your 20s. You know, you have it when you're before you're married or whatever. And I'd have to reshuffle a lot to get to the memorial that's on this Thursday. And it's a huge memorial. A gajillion people will be going. It will be recorded. It is not necessary for me to be, there will be thousands of people there probably because this guy, his father is somebody a lot of people knew. But there's some part of me that thinks this wouldn't have even been a question 40 years ago. I would have dropped everything and I wouldn't have lost touch with him.
Yeah.
Like, then again, I don't think I would have had a really close male friend 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's because of the same developments, you know, I mean, they're all of a piece. It's because life is what it is that one of my dearest friends is a guy, you know, I mean, that just wouldn't have even been, you know, you look at my mother, that's not
right,
true.
Right.
I think that relates to the limitations of our vocabulary. And part of the reason that I have been so obsessed with this piece of yours is I love the language of the thickness or the thinness of friendships. I love the moment when you talk about these two writers who are in conversation with one another and how their feelings became too hot to handle. Like just this comes up for me in friendships with men, too. Like, what is the range of acceptable obsession with a friend? When there is the possibility that it becomes uncomfortable for a spouse or something like that. We just don't have a lot of words to talk about those things and put them in any kind of context for ourselves or the other people in our lives who are affected by those really intense, thick friendships.
That is so true. And it's absolutely the kind of cross-gender friendships and spousal things can be incredibly intense. We take vacations together, my office spouse and I, and his spouse and my spouse, we're all friends. We all know each other very, very well. And we all know each other's kids. So thank God for that, right? I mean, and my husband was his editor too for a while. So I think they had an independent relationship. But it would have been bonkers otherwise. Because I find that my office spouse often says things that are more comforting to me than my husband does, in part because he's been spared hearing the exact same soundtrack every day for, you know, 18 years. Like my office spouse, though he's heard me whine a lot, it's less than my husband has, you know? It's like, it's still a little bit fresher. He's a little bit less worn down. But I do, I do agree. I think that, I mean, that's its own, I would read, I'm just telling you right now, if someone wrote a book about, you know, the complexities of office spouseship, I would,
yeah,
you know, I would get up in the middle of dinner to go buy that book.
I think it just speaks to that sort of multifaceted, like we're multifaceted. And so we have to have relationships that speak to all those multifaceted parts of ourselves. Like to think that one spouse or one sibling or one best friend can hold all the different, you know, it's almost like this paradox of that individuality. Well, yeah, a collective is the only thing up for that challenge. A collective is the only thing up for that uniqueness.
Well, and you need many buckets. Yeah. That's just it. And they are filling the place where your church or the Elks Club or your bowling league or whatever once was, right? And I think this was kind of the devastating problem with the 1950s companionate kind of model of marriage, where like husbands and wives couldn't do that for each other. And the wives really got the bum end of the stick. The men, I mean, you saw this in Mad Men played out pretty well, where the fellows all had like their camaraderie at work and the women were just screwed. They were screwed. They were alone in their big empty houses. And, you know, Betty Draper, just with her 1,000-yard stare and her cigarette, you know, like sitting there, you know, maybe finding some companionship with the women who were similarly screwed, who were trapped in their houses next door. I mean, Benny Friedan was onto something very real. You know, you need more. You need a lot more to make you whole and to capture you. I mean, you also need more fulfillments. I mean, I think that was her point, which doesn't necessarily mean work, but it does mean that you can't just be consigned to, you know, sitting at home all day and looking pretty, you know, and running a vacuum.
Well, speaking of paradox, I do have to say now that it's been 8 years since you wrote my favorite parenting book of all time, All Joy and No Fun,
Thanks.
The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Still pass it out to people.
Oh,
that's
you're the
me.
One?
That's Thanks. Me.
I was wondering where those three sales per month
that's
came
me.
From. Thank you.
When do we get a sequel? That's the first thing I want to know.
Never. Never. I hated writing a book. It was so lonely. Never.
Well, you did such a good job. And I'd love to hear how you think about that book now that you're farther along in your parenting journey, especially after the impact of pandemic parenting, because I think it speaks so well to that paradox of parenting. And I think it speaks some to parenting littles, but to me, it still feels relevant. But I wonder how you think about that book now.
You know, you're sweet. I guess I think, a few things. First of all, it's very dated in there. If you read it, I talk about Blackberries. There were no such thing as iPads, let alone multiplayer, you know, online video games. I mean, the idea that like the internet was going to sort of insinuate its tentacle, you know, its porn tentacles into our young boys and, you know, and that there was going to be TikTok and that everybody was going to have this outward facing. I mean, the perils, the kind of what our adolescent children were going to come across, none of that was apparent to me. And so, it would have been a different book in that sense, right? There would have been so much in the raising the adolescence chapter. And it would have been a different kind of book because, you know, it's also happening to the grownups. We are susceptible to some of the same things that our adolescents are. So it would have in that way been very hard to maybe even contain. It would have gotten unwieldy in a hurry because the internet is just not bringing out our finest selves. It's bringing out our inner adolescents, right? So,
that's
yeah.
An understatement.
Yeah, right, isn't it? So I look at it and I think that it's dated, number one. And then on the other hand, I think that some of it was like swept into the culture so quickly, the idea that parenting was like kind of a drag and sort of feel the same compulsion to be excellent at parenting in the same way that women in the 1950s felt obliged to be excellent housewives and to keep fine homes. I think all that stuff got subsumed very, very quickly. So its lessons were sort of absorbed. So now people don't even know where some of those ideas came from. A few years ago on Christmas Day, Claire Kane Miller had this front page story in the New York Times about how women were spending more time with their children now than they had in the 1960s. That's like on page 11 of my book and minute 4 of my TED Talk. And but like it was new to her.
Yeah.
You know, it was new to her. So she basically recapitulated the entire thesis of my book. Like, and I got a lot of tweets that day saying, why aren't you mentioned in this? And I was like, I don't know, you know, but like, it was, you know, it was all news to her. And, you know, it flew at high altitude, you know, like at the New York Times, most emailed and most read for like a week, you know, because it's news to a certain, you know, like 5 or 6 years later.
Everybody has to rediscover it.
No one remembers it. You said it. Yep. Everybody has to rediscover it, right? Everybody is rediscovering the same thing. And so, like, I just sat there kind of laughing, you know, I mean, there it all is again. People forget, you know, it just kind of gets reabsorbed in the culture. And then people go off and write it. So I feel like it is at once dated and a perennial. Yep.
Well, I think parts for me that the reason I still recommend it, I mean, reading that sort of history and realizing that the economically useless and emotionally priceless.
Yeah, that's
I quote
good.
That all the time. And I think more than, you know, you can't tell the future, but illuminating the past and the way we've changed and our thinking around parenting is always going to be helpful. And I think makes people feel less alone. And I think what you
Thank
did
you. Yeah,
in the book about particularly sort of gendered perceptions of parenting.
Yes, that holds up
so well. It's so helpful in the sense of like, well, the way that men parent, there's benefits to that. Like the idea that like the only right way to parent is the way women parent, and you know that the pressure that is on women, and the fact that there is children benefit from different styles and approaches. And I remember reading and feeling an enormous sense of like pressure release. Like, oh, okay, I see what's happening here. That's bigger than me. And I don't have to feel like I have to fix it or solve it. And that this is, you know, I still love that book. I still love that book.
I adore you for saying that. And I will say that that is the one part that I feel proudest of. And like it can still stand on its own two legs and will for really some time, I think. The end of the second chapter where Clint says, I am the standard. And his wife, Angie, can't bring herself to just think, I am the standard, meaning I'm good enough. There is no like crazy. I know how it came up. He didn't have a father who was very involved. So he felt like whatever he did was good and good enough. And whereas Angie had all these insane notions about what she had to do to be a perfect mom, rather than just going, you know,
good enough.
I hugged my kids today. The good enough parent idea that she just couldn't let herself off the hook, you know? Whereas her husband was like, what? They're protected. They're taken care of.
They're alive.
They're watching. I know. Today. Ball game one.
Yep.
You know, they're watching TV. They're cheerful and they're giggling. Like, how have I failed?
To me, that's like a thread in the friendship piece, too. We need a little bit of good enough with friends. Like, you don't have to reach out in a tough moment and say the perfect thing. Reaching out is good enough. You don't have to get together every Friday night for dinner. Reaching out and getting to dinner once every 6 months is good enough. Like, I think there's a little bit of that even in all our relationships that we do to each other and ourselves.
That's a great, great point. In fact, it reminds me of a hack that I'm now going to share with everybody that my friend Rachel did early on. She's a professor in upstate New York. And she wrote to me and she said, I'm writing you a long email and long emails are really intimidating. So I'm telling you that I would love a reply to this long email. And it can be like within the next couple of months, you know, and it doesn't have to be as long. Like just whenever you feel like you can reply, just send, you know, I just would love to hear from you. Know how you're, but like, think about somebody saying, answer me in 2 months. You know, I get an email and I'm like,
right.
You know, and also her saying, your email does not, like, I just wrote you a very long email. It does not have to be as long your reply. It would, you know, it's so generous. And it's setting it's a much more realistic sort of parameter, right?
If at any point in your relationships you can ease the pressure on people, lean into that instinct.
Oh, God. Totally.
Well, I have to ask you, you know, we are a politics podcast, and our theory of being a politics podcast is that all this stuff is the basis of the way that we express ourselves politically. Mm-hmm. Do you feel good enough in your relationships? Do you have enough relationships? How lonely are you? So I have to ask you, I'm really curious, as you have been studying Steve mm-hmm. Bannon, what connections you would draw between everything we've been talking about and the way that he has become, as you said, kind of a minister for people.
Oh, God, that is so fascinating. That is very, very perceptive. So Steve Bannon said something, this is going to speak directly, whiz-bang, to your point. Steve Bannon told Errol Morris in a documentary about him. Errol made a documentary about Steve Bannon in 2018 with like a not so great name called American Dharma. It was great if you understood Steve Bannon. It's not anything that's box office sexy. And he kind of got canceled for doing it, which was a shame because I think people ought to know what Steve Bannon is about. I'm mildly afraid at this point of getting canceled too, although I think we are slightly more enlightened about, you know, what happens when you don't know what's going on. Sub Rosa, I think people ought to know. You know, or not even separate, you know, not even the subterranean currents. These are just currents in American life that are happening that we're not paying attention to. Anyway, Steve Bannon said something to Errol Morris that was so chilling and so perceptive. He said when he was working for Internet Gaming Entertainment, he was in Hong Kong. He was astonished to discover how many men, grown men in their 30s, played all these multiplayer online games and how intensely they played them and how many hours they spent doing them. And he said, but then he sort of understood it because let's say that you are Dave in accounting and you drop dead one day, you're 250 pounds and you drop dead. You find some preacher who doesn't know you very well, who does a 10-minute eulogy based on a couple of things that a few people have said about you, and you get dropped into a urn and put into one of these perpetual cemeteries, and that's Dave. If Dave online dies, online Dave is Ajax. Mm. And thousands of people show up at Dave's funeral. And Dave is carried in a caisson to a giant raging funeral pyre. And the warring tribe that hated Dave comes out to fight. And everybody stays home for Dave's funeral. They miss a day of work. That's Dave online. Dave online is Ajax. Who is more real, Ajax or Dave? And that people relate better to their online avatars, their idealized selves or who they want to be. And he said, when I took over Breitbart, I had that top of mind when I built out the comment section because people, their online comments selves are their realer selves. They're who they want to be. They are their aspirational selves. And that is like, so the people who are trolls, the people who are the big online figures, you know, who are mobilizing the right. And he said, those selves properly directed and weaponized can be used in politics. Mm. Your online selves, those angry people can be, that energy properly directed can be put to political use.
And that's why it feels so disjointed to the, all of us living among the real world Daves.
Right. Correct. And I think, you know, we, those of us who live online, who don't live online, who live in the real world, can't quite understand what that energy is, what those alter ego energies are about, and how they can become some so inflamed, and how they can privately go into a voting booth and vote for someone reprehensible who understands their rage. Think about what happened on like January 6th. Mm-hmm. I mean, people came out as their real life avatars.
Yeah.
They were cosplaying. They were Ajax, right? They missed a day of work. They showed up at the Capitol with their own version of caissons, you know, and they were fighting and they were in face paint and fur. Think about that, you know?
Well, and I think the mass shootings are another reflection of that, where it crosses over into real life.
That's right. Think about, they all have these online manifestos. Mm-hmm. They've got these online cells. Or they live stream it, right? I mean, that's right. It's their online personas. I mean, it's fascinating. And I mean, Bannon is a fundamentally a media guy. He's an media impresario, right? He did Breitbart News. He made all these propaganda films, the most famous of which was about Sarah Palin. He understands this. And it's frightening. It's dangerous.
And it just seems to me that there's like the thread here is who might Dave have been if he had been invited in real life into some full expression of himself, and how would it be so dark?
Bingo. Yeah. What if he had a real church?
Yeah.
Although, of course, my colleague Tim Alberto just wrote the best thing that I think I've read this year about how the churches are turning.
Oh my gosh.
They're privileging politics over – that piece was so good, right? That they're privileging politics over spiritual identity and like and scripture. So this is a brand new question. You asked the exact right question. It's the Robert Putnam question. But what if that's getting lost now?
Yeah.
Where does one go just for fellowship? Just for love, just for support. I mean, I want my church to bring me casseroles when someone dies. I don't need them to tell me how to vote.
Well, I mean, that's definitely our theory here, is that at the end of the day, it's us together with each other, right? Like, we are the institution, we are the committee. Like, the friendships, the Helen and Bob marriages, the moments where we say, I see you, you don't have to go online to be seen. I see you. I think about all the time this, like, it was just like a short roundup in the Times of people talking about interactions with their conservative relatives. And somebody said, I had this cousin, he was getting in with the alt-right, and his sister, I think it was his sister or another female cousin, just wouldn't stop with him, just wouldn't give up on him. Just went at him and went at him and went at and eventually sort of extracted him from it. But she just wouldn't stop. She just wouldn't stop showing up in the face of conflict, in the face of hard conversations, just saying, I see you. You don't have to go there. I see you.
Two things to say to that. Oh, my God. Okay. So, number one, I was totally unrelatedly the chairwoman of the selection committee for the Pulitzers on nonfiction, because I'd been a book critic, you know, at the Times, one of the daily book critics for 2.5 years. And all I basically reviewed was nonfiction. So when I abandoned that gig, they asked me whether or not I wanted to go through, you know, all the entries, you know, and lead a committee to winnow it down to a group of three. And one of the books that we chose is called Homeland Security. And it's all about how banal radicals actually are, particularly, it's mainly Muslim fundamentalists, that they're mainly just lost boys. They're like normal adolescent teenagers. And when they are successful at de-radicalizing, it's always the sister, the mom, the people who know them. Oh, come on. You like chocolate ice cream and watching that mindless film, and like, you're you. You're you. You're not them. You're you. You're us. Right. So, and I loved that book, and you should read that book, and everyone should read that book. It's such a great book. It got totally overlooked. It was barely reviewed. It broke my heart. It's fabulous. So, A, that, yes, exactly what you just said about Thanksgiving, but to the like 100th power. The second thing is, yes, let's go back to the McElveins, right? Where we've got a conspiracy theorist husband and a mom who is indifferent or might privately think that most of this stuff is just kind of loopy. Right. What's their bond? They are the only two people who knew what it was to lose that boy. They loved this boy so much. It's their love. And that they went through that grief side by side. And they are the only, they knew him for 26, almost 27 years. And who else can relate to that? Can relate to losing that? Only those two. And as long as they understood that each one's expression of grief was an expression of love and love by another means, like, and that it was Helen saying about her husband, how can I stop him from doing what he's doing? He is fighting for his son in the way that he knows how. People might see it as a sign of, you know, crazy. I see it as an expression of love. It was so beautiful. And when you reinterpret someone you love that way, it's different. But grieving is lonely. So clearly he found fellowship with all these 9/11 truthers, right? But Helen is still steadfastly by his side, you know, and I'm hoping he can just at some point replace all that weird fellowship that he's getting with truthers with his grandkids and Helen alone, and that can really do the trick.
Well, thank you for sharing their stories. Thank you for all your writing and this thread that we've been pulling on together, and thank you for coming on our show. We adore you. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh my God, I've adored this conversation. I will remember this conversation.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Middle-aged brain termites or none.
And you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Thank you so much.
I'd love to come back. Okay. Thank you guys.
Thank you to Jennifer Senior. She really is. She's like my most favorite internet writer. I love her so much. I think she's so smart. And we're friends now. I think she knows that. I think we established that during the course of the interview. But if she doesn't know it, she will know it soon.
Yeah, she'll have to just learn that you collect people and that you you desire to collect her. Now, she was lovely to talk to you. It really was an honor to get to spend that time with her. Couldn't have enjoyed it more. And I do. I think about that piece constantly.
Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles. But how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine. Instead of just slathering more products on my face, it feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never-frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code pantsuit50 at factormeals.com/pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Beth, you have returned home, but you were at my house for a week. We thought we'd give the people a little fun summary behind the scenes. I don't know what we're calling this, about your time at my house.
We left my house on Saturday morning and went to Holiday World and Splash and Safari in Santa Claus, Indiana, a beloved amusement park of my childhood days.
Free sunscreen. It's my favorite
part. Free drinks, free parking, free sunscreen.
Mm-hmm.
We try to explain to our children that it's not free, it's included. We've been talking about that distinction.
I heard you say that. I thought that was very good.
It's not free, it's included. But so we spent the day there with our really good friends and neighbors, then all spent the night at my parents' house. It was really fun to get to see them. And then Chad came home with our friends, and Jane, Ellen, and I drove to your house. And when we got there on Sunday, Jane was already saying she was homesick.
This is my favorite moment, you guys. She was like out on our porch, and she was a little teary. I was like, what's wrong, Jane? And she said, I'm just homesick. And I went, oh, when did you leave for Holiday World? And Beth said, yesterday. And Jane was like, that's not right. And Beth was like, mm-hmm. It was yesterday.
It was yesterday.
Perfect. I just really would like to start one of these times, whether you're coming to my house or I'm going to your house, where one of my boys doesn't make one of your girls cry.
That's too high a bar, because my girls are criers. You know, they just are. Every day's a roller coaster. It's okay.
It just makes me, you know, Felix was so excited for you to get here, and he immediately made Ellen cry. I'm not really sure. Oh, I think you told her she needed to practice saying yes, and then he tried to make her kiss the watermelon. He wanted her to say yes to kiss the watermelon. Yeah. She didn't like that.
She just decided to be in a bad mood for a couple of days, but she shook it off. She still had a good time.
Luckily, she got some awards at Camp Invention. I feel like that sort of righted the ship.
That helped for sure. I think it was a really good thing for me to get to see, you know, because we work so closely together and are such big figures in each other's lives, but we do it all remotely. I think it was a really important thing for me to learn about what your day-to-day is like since Felix's diagnosis with type 1 diabetes, and to really watch how
it's
you
intense.
And Nicholas have to manage that, because it is, I mean, you know, we called the episode where you talked about that a life-changing diagnosis, and to see the effect on your minute-to-minute was, I think, really significant.
It's really intense. There's a lot of checking the Dexcom. There's a lot of, is he high? Is he low? Does he need candy? Does he need this? You were here for a momentous moment when I emailed our doctor and threw myself at her mercy and said, please don't make me wait a month and a half to come to a pre-pump education class where you tell me about what kind of pumps you have when I know what kind of pump I want. And she said, okay. And it was amazing. And so now we're really on our way to a pump, which I really hope changes that sort of minute-to-minute situation that we're dealing with, because it is. It's intense. It's exhausting. You know, it's like COVID, though. It's like you adapt so quickly to a changed situation. It's like, what was it like when we just sat down and ate? Like, I don't even remember. I'm such a like present oriented person. Thank God. Because it's like, I've like kind of forgotten, because now that's not what it's like. We don't just sit down and eat ever.
Yeah. I learned by the end of the week that unexpected treats are a real problem. You know, we were at the closing ceremony for the camp and hearing, oh, the ice cream truck's coming. I thought, oh no, like, I don't think Felix is prepared for the ice cream truck. And so just getting that education in person, I think was really important for me as your business partner and friend. And I also think it just was a reminder, you know, we try to get together in the month of June and sort of parent collectively, just as a mechanism to make it through the summer when we have kids at home and the work that we do requires quiet and a lot of thought and a lot of reading. And it helps to be together. And it also, we still can't manage like that focused big block of time to sit down and think about something.
Yeah, I really thought we would have it this week. They were gone from 9 to 3, but man, between, you know, the news brief and More to Say and recording and then this and then that. And then, bam, the day was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Just like every other school day.
It's like time just melts, you know, it just melts.
But now I'm heading to your house. We got thrown a curveball this morning. All the kids were supposed to be at sleepaway camp. And then Felix's diabetes camp emailed me the day and said, JK, you're not dropping off on Sunday. You're dropping off on Wednesday because we don't have enough staff and we have to split the week up. And so now they're going to be mini sessions. Jesus, take the wheel.
And I just, you know, I bring up sort of the struggle of the whole thing working with kids during the summer, because we are ideally positioned. We are our own bosses. Mm-hmm. This is an independent show. We are accountable only to like the integrity that we feel in terms of our commitments to listeners. And so we can really do a lot of adaptation, and it is still so hard. So I mean, there are so many families that I think, what would happen if the camp came in and said, actually, these 2 days that you thought were covered aren't covered now? I mean, we'll yeah. figure it out. It's hard. We'll figure it out. But like so many people can't do that.
Yeah, it is. It's just it's so intense. And, you know, doing all this and dealing with the summer along with the heat wave and the January 6th trial. Whew, I don't know, guys.
And a flood of Supreme Court opinions.
I don't know, guys. I don't know. Pray for us for the rest of the week. Thoughts and prayers to the team here at Pansy Politics and every other American.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad we're all here together.
Together is all we have. All right. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Pantsuit Politics. We will be back in your ears on Friday after two more January 6th hearings, and we'll be putting up some summaries on Instagram in between time. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Pantsuit Politics, and until Friday, keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production. Elise Knapp is our managing director.
Maggie Penton is our community engagement manager. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Linda Daniel.
Allie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Helen Handley.
Tiffany Hassler.
Emily Holiday.
Katie Johnson.
Katina Zuganellis-Kasling.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
The Creeps.
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
Emily Neasley.
The Pettons.
Tawny Peterson.
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Katie Steigers.
Karen True.
Annika Uvaline.
Nick and Elisa Vallelli.
Katherine Vollmer.
Amy Whited.
Jeff Davis. Melinda Johnston. Ashley Thompson. Michelle Wood. Joshua Allen. Morgan McHugh. Nicole Berkless. Paula Bremer. And Tim Miller.
We hope that everybody has the best. Oh my God, of course.
Cookie, hush! Cookie, come! Cookie! Come here! Cookie, come! Cookie! Cookie!
I swear on nothing sacred at all. All right, one more time. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Pantsuit Politics. And until Friday, keep it nuanced, y'all.